Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
It's our 6th annual summer reading list.
I came here to strangle you.
Nothing I wrote was untrue.
What do you mean? That book makes me have to be like Lee Harvey Oswald.
It's an honest account of our marriage.
Summer is a time for many things. Catching up on the garden, heading to the beach, exotic vacations in foreign lands.
But the best thing about summer? Catching up on books you've always meant to read.
But I'm narcissistic.
Don't you think you're a little self-obsessed?
And misanthropic and self-righteous.
Well, I wrote some nice things about you.
Like what? What?
Like what? Like you cry when you see Gone with the Wind.
What books should thoughtful people be reading this summer?
Look, I better warn you. I've had some interest in this book for a movie sale.
It's our annual summer reading show.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, it's our annual summer reading show.
Ken, we've got a really bright audience. That's clear when they phone in on regular times, and it's particularly clear on this show when we get such interesting suggestions for reading. By the end of the show, we're going to have a list up on our website that will keep any intelligent person busy all summer long.
Yeah, we're going to talk to some readers and thinkers who have been guests on this show about their summer reading plans. And we're also going to hear lots of suggestions from those well-read listeners you mentioned.
But let's get started with some picks of our own. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time this summer reading books by the German author Bernard Schlink. That's S-C-H-L-I-N-K.
Schlink is the author of The Reader, which was made into a great movie a couple years ago. I love that movie. I know you love that movie because we gave it a Dionysus Award. That's our answer to the Oscars. We gave it a Dionysus Award a couple years ago for Best Moral Dilemma.
But Schlink has written far more than that.
So give us some examples.
Well, for one thing, he has a number of pretty good detective novels. I read some of these after I read The Reader. His detective's name is Self, so they have cool names like Self's Punishment, that was the first one he wrote, I think, and Self's Deception and Self's Murder. If you like mystery and crime novels, you'll like these.
Now, the titles sound very philosophical of those. Are those as philosophical as The Reader?
Well, for mystery novels, they're sort of philosophical, but no, not as morally deep as The Reader. But he's got two other fiction books that sound like they continue with these deep themes of guilt and memory that we found in The Reader. And he's also got a nonfiction book called Guilt About the Past, based on lectures at Oxford. In fact, it sounds like philosophy and criticism mixed together.
You sound like you're really getting into Schlink, man.
Well, I have a sort of a curiosity about him. He and I are both war babies. I was born in the U.S. in 1943, as we were starting to win the war, and he was born in Germany in 1944, when they were well into losing it. I find the experience of Germans of my generation very intriguing.
So tell us more about the Schlink books you plan to read.
Well, the novel is The Homecoming. Its protagonist is someone about Schlink's age, but not during the era explored in The Reader, but a little later, during the era of East and West Germany. One reviewer called it his most powerful and disquieting book. So I'm really looking forward to lying on the beach and being disquieted. So, Ken, what's your plans for this summer's reading?
Well, my reading list has a distinctive feature this summer. I have lots of projects this summer. I want to read stuff that's fun, but it's got to be short. Short poetry, short prose, short form. I'm reading only short form this summer.
Well, give us what's on the top of the list.
Well, for example, one of my favorite authors, one of the most provocative thinkers alive today, Nassim Taleb. We've had him on our program. He wrote The Black Swan. He's now written a book called The Bed of Procrustes. It's a book of aphorisms, right? They're short aphorisms, stand alone. And he says, and one of the things he says is that only nerds ask for explanation of aphorisms. So they're little short things. I'll give you an example.
Yeah, give us a couple of Taleb's better aphorisms.
Well, I don't know about better, but here's one. The person you are the most afraid to contradict is yourself. An idea starts to be interesting when you get scared of taking it to its logical conclusion. Now, all these aphorisms, what they have in common, this is a bed of Procrustes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Procrustes put the short people in the long bed and tried to stretch them out, and put the long people in the short bed and tried to cut their extremities off to make the person fit the bed rather than the bed fit the person. Taleb thinks that's what the human mind is like. That's what human life is like. We don't know how to deal with black swans. We don't know how to adjust. Our brains are evolved for the Stone Age, and we're in this modern informational age, and we just don't know what to make of it. And instead of writing a long discursive thing to illustrate that, he's got all the hundreds of pithy aphorisms. But you can read each one in a few seconds. If you're on the beach, you can go take a swim, come back, read a few more, go have lunch, read a few more. It's perfect for the way I intend to approach my summer.
Well, as the show goes on, Ken, I'm going to try to get you to share a couple of more of these short things from your list. But in a moment, we'll be joined by our first guest, someone who pays close attention to literary developments. That's John McMurtry, book critic at the San Francisco Chronicle.
First, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, wonders what teenagers are reading this summer. She files this report.
Novels for young adults are rife with moral and ethical dilemmas. They deal with heavy issues like suicide, abuse, and cruelty. But they can also be light and funny and filled with fantasy. There's J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, or Forever by Judy Blume. We all have a memorable book from our youth that stays with us like a first kiss. Mine was a novel called Tenderness by Robert Cormier, about a runaway girl who falls in love with a serial killer. I read that book over and over.
I really liked The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls.
Right now, I'm reading Iona, The Lost Dragoneye. It's a sequel to Eon, Dragoneye Reborn.
The one I really liked that I've read recently would be 13 Reasons Why. Things she was saying in the book I could relate to, like peer pressure and gossip.
One of the books I'm going to be recommending this year is called Trash by Andy Mulligan.
Emma Coleman is a children's librarian at the Berkeley Public Library. Trash is a book about three teenagers who pick through a dump site to survive in an unnamed third world country. Then one day, they find something that could change their lives forever, and they're faced with a dilemma.
Do they steal $6 million that's been siphoned off the public coffers by a corrupt politician? You have no question in your mind that absolutely, they should. They should. And so you're, you know, it's a story where you're rooting for three kids to get away with what is ostensibly a crime.
The children find a mysterious key. Doors, locks, and keys become a motif throughout the book. The young heroes are forced to navigate the gritty, stinking reality of absolute poverty. There's even a scene where a policeman beats one of the street kids. But there's also beauty, hope, and redemption in the book Trash. Here's another summer reading recommendation from teen librarian Will Marston.
Shipbreaker by Paolo Bagciacalupi is a wonderful science fiction book.
Shipbreaker is set in a post-apocalyptic water world where sea level has risen and wiped out coastal cities. Like Mulligan's Trash, Bagciacalupi's novel is about a teenage scavenger of sorts. 17-year-old Naylor cruises around the Gulf Coast looking for shipwrecks to pillage. And one day, he finds a ship that's brimming with treasure.
And inside, along with all these treasures, they find one survivor, a young girl, and they have the choice of killing her.
So what do? Naylor's drug-addicted father would have him slit the girl's throat and steal her riches. But the boy decides not to and suffers the consequences. In this book, human extravagance has destroyed the world. The characters are left in a brutal, ugly landscape.
When you're dealing with survival like that, how does that affect family issues, loyalty among friends, and doing the right thing?
Another book that deals with death is Before I Fall by Lauren Oliver. This recommendation comes from Joy Shiosta, also at the Berkeley Public Library.
Some people have described the book as a cross between Mean Girls and Groundhog Day, in that the main character starts out as a very shallow high school student and often very cruel to some of her peers.
But then the main character, Sam, dies in a car accident. And she has the opportunity to relive her last day, not once, but seven times, until she gets it right.
And she changes a lot during the novel.
Friendship and bullying come up a lot in these novels. Whether set in a dump, a post-apocalyptic water world, or a regular high school. Which is perhaps why these books have become so popular. Teens can relate. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And today, it's our sixth annual Summer Reading Show. What philosophical reading will you tackle this summer? The latest research on the meaning of life? One of the classics you've never read in school? Or are you still looking for something to get you started?
We're joined now by John McMurtry. He's book critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. It's part of his job to keep his ear to the literary ground, and I guess the philosophical ground, too. And he's got some ideas for thought-provoking summer reading. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hello, gentlemen. Good to be here, and thanks for having me on.
Tell us one or more of your suggestions for what people ought to be reading of a philosophical nature this summer.
Sure. Well, there's Gary Wills's latest book. It's a short read, and it's about Augustine. It's about his Confessions. It's called Augustine's Confessions, a biography.
Now, Augustine's Confessions, I like Augustine as a philosopher. I like his Confessions, and I like Gary Wills. Mm-hmm. But I do think he likes Augustine as a person. I like Augustine as a writer and a philosopher, but I think he must have been pretty much a megalomaniac as a person. What do you think?
Well, I'm not an expert, certainly, but you do come off liking the guy, feeling sympathy for him, and listening back to your show with James O'Donnell, which I would recommend to listeners if they haven't heard that one, to listen to the podcast. I think you really get his humanity. It comes through, and that's one of the amazing things about his story is that he's a saint, certainly, but he wasn't always a saint. It's a story about his transformation.
So this book is Wills' book about Augustine is specifically about Augustine's Confessions? Specifically,
yes.
About the writing of that book and what Augustine went through?
It's, as the title says, Augustine's Confessions, a biography. So it's a look at the book.
Well, it's a very important book. I mean, I'm no expert on the history of literature, but I understand it's really the first or one of the first biographies ever written, and certainly one of the first that got personal about his sex life. I mean, not by modern standards, but by standards of the time, it's pretty explicit.
But if you hadn't read if you hadn't read the Confessions, would this make you like want to go out and read the Confessions? Is it a way into Augustine that...
I think it is a way into... For people who've read it or haven't, I think there's so much that people have read from decades ago. I can speak personally that you need a refresher course, right? So this acts in that way.
So you think this is a great read for the summer, and it may lead people to read and reread Augustine's Confessions, which I think is, in many ways, one of the great reads of the great books, you know, because it's so personal and it's so intellectual. It's a very sort of probing kind of...
At least the first 10 chapters. It gets pretty heavy after that.
All the stuff about time.
That's a lot of beach time.
So you got any more suggestions for us?
Sure. I'm going to move on to T.C. Boyle, who's... a great author, novelist, short story writer, and his most recent book came out, I think, just a couple months ago. It's called When the Killing's Done, and it's fun as always. This one takes place in Southern California on the Channel Islands, Santa Cruz Island in particular, and it's really about these two environmentalists who are pitted against one another and about their philosophies of... what needs to be done to protect the creatures of this island. One's pretty crazy, and he wants to protect every creature, regardless of how they got there. Another works for the government, and she is a little more reasonable. She wants to protect only the indigenous creatures, and she believes in wiping out a few to do that. Too many rats and pigs, invasive species, if you will.
So there sounds like there's a deep, interesting kind of dilemma in this book.
Yes, and the thing about Boyle, too, is he throws it out there for you. He doesn't telegraph his feelings. He doesn't preach. And it's a story with these moral dimensions that's couched in a very entertaining and thrilling adventure. A lot of it actually takes place at sea in wintry conditions, but nonetheless, it's a great book to read. If you maybe are at a beach and you think about all the horrific things that happen in the ocean, a lot of people in the novel do die, and so it's satisfying in that way, certainly.
Yeah. So, John, on that note, thank you for joining us. It's been great having you on Philosophy Talk.
My pleasure. It was fun. Thank you.
We've been joined by John McMurtry. He's the book editor of the San Francisco Chronicle.
He suggested Augustine's Confessions, a Biography by Gary Wills, and When the Killing's Done by T.C. Boyle. He also, as a book editor, he reads a lot, and he's got a lot of suggestions for philosophically minded readers, and we'll put a list up on our website of his ideas.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're putting together our annual summer reading list.
What's on your list? What have you already read that you'd recommend to others? After the break, we'll get suggestions from a novelist and old friend of the program, Irv Yalom.
Philosophical Fiction, when Philosophy Talk continues.
One day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm going to do it again, yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
It's the summer reading list edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What are the most amazing philosophical reads you've ever experienced? What works of fiction are you dying to read again? If you were going to read only one philosophically rich book this summer, what would it be?
We're joined now by Irv Yalom. He's a well-known novelist and psychiatrist, and he's been on the program to talk about Schopenhauer as well as overcoming the terror of death.
Irv, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoy being back there. I think I've been there 3 or 4 times at least.
Yeah, and we always love having you. So what are you reading this summer? I hear you're writing a book this summer.
Yeah, I just finished a book about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's been a 3-year chore, and it's called The Spinoza Problem. And it's a novel about what the inner world of Spinoza might have been. And I've also got a subplot in it with in the Nazi period, looking at one of the Nazi ideologues named Alfred Rosenberg.
So wait a minute. What's the connection between the 17th century and the Nazi period? How's that segue? How's that transition?
It's fragile. It's fragile. The Nazis, when they invaded Holland, confiscated Spinoza's library. There was an organization that was in charge of all the looting of Europe called the ERR, and that the R in that, it's the task force of Rosenberg, Alfred Rosenberg. So the Rosenberg groups came in and confiscated Spinoza's library, it's about 130 volumes or so, and we have the description of the confiscation signed by the Nazi officer who actually did it. And there's a sentence in there saying, this should help us with the Spinoza problem. So that's the really centerpiece of the novel. What could the Nazi Spinoza problem be?
I don't think. So you're not going to give it away, I assume.
I won't give it away, but
you've certainly intrigued me. The Nazi Spinoza problem.
Yes.
I mean, it seems obvious to me that it must be connected to their anti-Semitism and their treatment of the Jews and all that stuff.
Well, not only that, but also the Nazis absolutely revered. There are great thinkers like Goethe and Schelling and all the Hegel, and those thinkers all revered Spinoza.
Now, is this Alfred Rosenberg? Was he the guy that was kind of a second-rate or third-rate or fourth-rate philosopher that
exactly.
Hitler befriended?
He fancied himself a philosopher, but in fact, and his book called The Myth of the 20th Century was a million-book bestseller, second only to Mein Kampf in Germany.
So people should know that you like writing these novels that are philosophical and psychological and all this stuff, because you've got, it's When Nietzsche Wept, right?
Oh, Nietzsche Wept.
And this Schopenhauer Cure. And
that's
now,
right.
Right, and now the Spinoza Problem.
That's right. I'm working my way down the line there, but Spinoza's always been very intriguing to me. Maybe it's because tend to be an iconoclast too, and anybody who gets excommunicated by the Jews at 25 and also put on the prohibited list by the Catholics and the Lutherans, he must have been doing something pretty interesting.
Right, so now, does Spinoza's philosophy, his philosophical doctrines, his ethics, and his dual aspect theory of mind and all that stuff, does that play a deep role in this?
My plan is to teach the layman what Spinoza is really doing. And so I am trying to explain his philosophy to people who don't understand him very well, and that includes myself.
I was going to say.
And, I've had to learn a lot about this, and I'm trying to present why he was doing this and why it changed the world. This one man in the 17th century, I think, introduced modernity. He really changed the world.
Really?
Well, it sounds like a great book, Irv, and I'm definitely going to put it on my summer reading list. But I'm anxious for you to, you haven't written your book on Hume yet.
No. If I weren't so old, I think that'd be the one I would tackle. Hume or Hobbes, perhaps.
But now, people can't actually read your book this summer, can they?
No. It'll be out next March.
Okay, so in your next summer's reading list.
My next summer's reading list, yeah.
But Irv, this has been fun having you back on Philosophy Talk. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's always good talking to you, Ken.
We've just heard from Irv Yalom, psychiatrist, novelist, and philosopher. It's Philosophy Talk's 6th annual summer reading show. Ken, I think it's time for you to share another one of your little short things you're going to read this summer with us. How about the poetry?
Well, I've got a poem by one of my favorite poets and one of my favorite philosophers. You know, most summers I say I'm going to read Proust. I'm going to finally get through Proust, but, you know, I'm doing short stuff this summer. And this guy, I bet you can guess who he is. He's been on this program. He's an award-winning poet, and he's a very fine philosopher.
You've got to be talking about Troy Jollymore.
Right. Troy's first book of poems won a prize from the National Book Critics Circle. And that was called Tom Thompson in Purgatory, and that's a really fine book of poems. But his follow-up is at least as fine, even finer. It's called At Lake Skookgog by Troy Jollymore, A Book of Poems. And here's a very philosophical poem of his. It's called The Solipsist. Don't be misled. That sea song you hear when the shell's at your ear, it's all in your head. That primordial tide, the slurp and salt slosh of the brain's briny wash, is on the inside. Truth be told, the whole place, everything that the eye can take in to the sky and beyond into space, lives inside of your skull. When you set your sad head down on Procrustes' bed, you lay down the whole universe. You recline on the pillow. The cosmos grows dim. The soft ghost in the squishy machine, which the world is, retires. Someday it will expire. Then all will go silent and dark. For the moment, however, the blackness is just temporary. The planet you carry will shortly swing back from the far nether regions, and life will continue. But only within you, which raises a question that comes up again and again as to why God would make ear and eye to face outward, not in.
Ken has just read us a poem from At Lake Skookgog. That's the most recent book by Troy Jollymore, poet-philosopher. You can get a complete list of all the books we're talking about at philosophytalk.org. You're listening to Philosophy Talk's annual summer reading show.
And we've got a caller in the line now, Barbara in Portland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Barbara.
Thank you.
So, Barbara, what's your suggestion for summer reading?
Well, the best book I read in the last year is The Good Psychologist, and it's by Noam Spencer. It is a novel. It talks about the therapist's office and his patients. It talks about the therapist's private life, which is not known to the patients, but therapy helps you know yourself, and that's what philosophy is partly about. Aristotle and Socrates, know thyself.
That's right. Psychology is just an offshoot of philosophy. Now, what makes this work as a novel? Is it a mystery novel or a love novel or a romance novel or a suspense novel or what?
Well, I think it's how people get through a difficult transition in life. It's we all deal with, in some degree, we deal with that. And it's an example of how we can do that creatively, going through a difficult transition. And there are varying degrees of that.
So Barbara, what? Tell me something about this novel that will make me want to read it and read it as a philosophically minded reader.
The one of the patients' story is very, very difficult. She's a single mother. She has to figure out how she's going to make a living and keep her daughter. I mean, this is one of these really frequent problems in this culture. And if you want to know how people get through something like this, this would be a good example of how she is helped by the therapist. The therapist, a good therapist, does not tell you what to do. He guides you through dialogue and discovery.
So this is a novel about self-discovery, self-exploration in difficult times, and the art of therapy that helps you get through that. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, absolutely.
So, Barbara, your suggestion is The Good Psychologist, a novel by Norm Spencer. It sounds like a good read to me, and I'm going to put it on my list. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you. And you know, two heads are better than one.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk's annual summer reading show.
We've got a caller all the way from Auckland, New Zealand. That's Zach, and he's on the line now.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Zach.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
So we're so glad you're calling. What's your suggestion for our fast listening audience around the world? Summer reading. Well, it's actually winter reading down there, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, it's just turning into winter now. So, I would really like to recommend Shakespeare's Coriolanus.
So tell us about this particular Shakespeare play.
Well, what's really interesting about this play is it's one that explores the nature of nobility, and asks questions about whether or not we are naturally noble, that is, whether we are born with a type of intrinsic strength, in the sense of, you know, Plato's Republic, where you have the guardians who are born with gold and the workers who are born with the bronze substance. Kind of essentialism, so to speak. And it explores this theme of natural nobility in the main character, Coriolanus, who is shown as kind of having preternatural strength. But he is problematically associated with the patricians, and he's shown to be uneducated and unrefined. And so he can often lash out with censuring words against the plebeians. And so it's a story about both natural nobility and also the conflict between the nobles and the commoners or the patricians and the plebeians.
Is Coriolanus a tragedy?
Yeah, it's considered a tragedy because I think if Shakespeare follows Plutarch's lead, which from Plutarch's Life of Coriolanus, the play is modeled on that. And so it takes the idea of hamartia, which is a kind of a character flaw, I think, and shows that in the play to some extent. But at the same time, he has intrinsic qualities as a leader, as a warrior.
So on the great pantheon of Shakespeare's tragedy, King Lear, Hamlet, where does Coriolanus fit in this pantheon of great Shakespeare works?
It's one of the best. And actually, most critics, from Coleridge all the way to, you know, Schlegel, suggest that it's Shakespeare's best tragedy of all times.
That's high praise. What do you know what happened to Coriolanus? Why is it not, at the top of people?
I don't know. I think it has to do with I'm speculating now with the political zeitgeist, because I think during World War II, the play, for example, was put on by Nazi Germany, and the character Coriolanus was portrayed as this kind of absurd Superman type. And the consequence of that has been a German recreation of the play by Bertolt Brecht, where it reverses the roles of the plebeians. It makes Coriolanus out to be a completely awful figure, and the people to be the real heroes. So
now that you mention the Brecht version, I think I saw that once.
Okay.
And I remember not liking it at all, and it may have killed my interest in Coriolanus.
Well, Zach, that's a great suggestion. You have actually intrigued me. I love Shakespeare, and I've read a lot of Shakespeare, but Coriolanus has not been on my list of must-reads or must-see, but now you've made me want to go out and read, and actually I want to see some performances of this.
Yeah, it's too bad, and there is a new performance which you'll have an opportunity to see on the silver screen, because Ray Fiennes has actually directed, and he also performs in a new version of Coriolanus coming out.
So, hey, man, you may be right ahead of the time. There's going to be this Coriolanus revival, and you have helped get it started.
People will say, we heard it first on Philosopher Talk.
From Zach in Auckland, New Zealand. Thank you for joining us. It's been great having you on Philosopher Talk.
Thank you very much, guys.
This is Philosophy Talk, and we're compiling our annual summer reading list.
And Eric in Sacramento's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Eric.
Hi, how are you doing?
So, Eric, can you tell us what it is you're recommending for our summer reading?
Yeah, I'm a lover of short stories, and I'm recommending a short story by Leo Tolstoy called The Devil, and The Library of Babel by Jorge Luis Borges.
Now, Tolstoy wrote War and Peace, which isn't too short. How short are his short stories?
No, I know, that's big. It's maybe 20 pages. It's not very big.
So tell us about what do you love about this short story, and why should philosophically minded us readers want to put this on their summer reading list?
It's just what I like about it philosophically is it's just so accurate. I think it points out addiction and just how fallible the human mind is, and how, you know, you think you have control over something, and then next thing you know, you don't. And, you know, just really, really accurate on showing man's struggle with, you know, with things.
Well, I'm going to follow your advice. After I finished War and Peace, I kind of put off getting involved with Tolstoy again. But a 20-page short story sounds about right. Now, Borges wrote the shortest short story I've ever read, which is called Borges and I. Is that on your list?
Yes. You know, anything, the book called Collected Fictions is the only one I've read of his. And I've read a lot of them. The Library of Babel, Circular Ruins, Pedro Salvadores, Borges and I.
Are they good as stories, as good as narrative? Do you find Borges' stories compelling as narrative fiction, or is it just abstract thinking about these complex questions?
Yeah, there's a couple things. One thing, he's a writer's writer. I mean, he's so good at delivering his points, and he's such an eloquent writer. Yeah, it's that and the philosophy, just the out there ideas, a way that you've never maybe have thought about the idea, but he puts it in a way that you probably never would have thought about it on your own. He always ends his stories in a way that leaves you guessing. He never really answers something. He leaves you with a question that just gnaws at you and makes you think about it, which is just wonderful.
Eric, you've been a wealth of information. I love the short story form, and it's great for the summer because your attention span is a little short in the summer.
Eric in Sacramento has recommended for our summer reading short stories by Tolstoy, in particular The Devil, and Borges, in particular The Library of Babel.
Eric, thank you for those great recommendations.
Hey, no problem.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're compiling our annual summer reading list.
We've talked about fiction and philosophy. We've gotten some great ideas from our listeners. In our next segment, we're going to continue with nonfiction. We'll be joined by a past guest, renowned anthropologist Helen Fisher. And we'll be joined by another friend with interesting summer reading plans, linguist and commentator Jeff Nunberg.
More summer reading picks from our friends and our listeners when Philosophy Talk continues.
The devil inside, every single one of us, the devil inside, devil inside, the devil inside, every single one of us, the devil inside.
Every minute after midnight, all the time I'm spending, it's just for working on the rewrite, that's right, I'm gonna turn it into cash.
It's our annual summer reading show. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
We're now joined by a past guest of the show, Helen Fisher. Helen is biological anthropologist at Rutgers University, and she's chief scientific advisor to the internet dating site, chemistry.com.
Helen, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Helen, word is going around that you have a book that seemed to us might make a great addition to our summer reading list. Can you tell us a little about your latest book?
My most recent book is on personality and where it comes from, and it's called Why Him, Why Her. And the book right before that was Why We Love, and I looked at the brain circuitry of romantic love and the evolution of romantic love, and 10 million people have now taken my questionnaire in 40 countries through this dating site, chemistry.com, and also match.com. And it's not just supernatural, it's not just a mystery, and it's not just philosophy. There's a great deal of biology to who you're drawn to. There's biology to why you misunderstand people. There's biology to how you can reach into somebody else's brain to make a better relationship. Relationships are serious, and studying them seriously is something I think is important.
So to the average but intelligent person, knowing about how serotonin and dopamine and these other factors are entering into things and can screw things up is really going to be helpful.
Can you imagine a time when on dating services it lists not just your interests, hobbies, and all that, but your biological kind of makeup?
My most recent book, I actually joked about this, that someday, I don't think it's going to happen, no, because I don't think that that many people are interested in chemistry and understand the links between personality and chemistry, nor do they really care. But
should they,
though? I do think they care about who they fall in love with, and I do think they care very much about why this person behaves the way that person actually behaves, and this book and biology can help them understand
that. No, I understand that, and I think it's a deep scientific question, and I'm all for that kind of scientific approach. But I'm just wondering whether the science can really translate into anything that would help us guide our behavior in trying to plan our romantic lives. Right? I mean, it might be, you know, I could say to myself, you know what, the reason this didn't work out between you and me is not because you're such an ass, but because we just don't have the right biochemical connections. Do you think we'll ever come to think about it like that? Should we come to think about it like that?
I'm not in the should business, but I'm not in the business of what people should and shouldn't do, but I do think that it can be extremely enlightening. For example, when I first handed in the book, Why Him, Why Her, to the editor, it was a rough draft, and I was waiting for his response, and he called, and there was a very long pause, and then he said to me, he said, you know what, Helen, I finally understand my son. And I do think that it can enormously help you understand that somebody is stubborn because they're stubborn. It's not about you. They can't wait to get out of the house, and they're restless, and it's not about you. You can go along with them. They'd like to have you with them, but they're on their way out because that's who they are. I think the more we can come to understand some of the biology of some very complex behavior patterns that we have, the more we can really reach somebody where they live.
We've been talking to Helen Fisher, a former guest on the program, who talked to us about her two recent books, both of which sound like they'd make fine summer reading that might actually help you with your relationships. Why Him, Why Her, and Why We Love the Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love.
Helen, those are great suggestions. They were lots of people suggested them to us, so we thought we'd just get it straight from the horse's mouth. So I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Ken, you're just reading short books this summer. You got another short one to tell us about?
Yeah, I do. This is a lovely little book called Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day. It's written by Robert Roland Smith. It's about how you can use the insights of philosophy just to illuminate and to help you think more deeply about everyday life. So its chapters are things like waking up, getting ready, traveling to work, being at work, going to the doctor, having lunch with your parents, and on and on, watching TV. And each chapter, he brings to bear the insights of not just philosophy, but psychology, linguistics, history, to illuminate what you're up to when you're doing a thing like shopping.
Well, so, for example, what are you up to when you're doing a thing like shopping?
Well, look, especially if you're using a credit card, he talks a lot about credit and money and fiat money, and he talks about consumption. He brings in Marx and all this stuff. In the chapter on having lunch with your parents, he talks about intergenerational obligations, and Malthus, who talks about population growth and why people have kids and all this stuff. And it's just this lovely book. And each chapter is only a few pages long. So it's a book you can take to the beach, read a chapter, go swim, come back, read another chapter.
Is there a chapter on going to the beach?
Well, there's a chapter on going to the gym and a chapter on taking a bath. So that's close enough. There's chapters on having sex and arguing with your partner. And each chapter, it wraps in some really fine philosophizing and psychologizing. So I think it's a cool little book.
Well, it sounds like a cool little book. Give us the title again.
It's called Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day by Robert Roland Smith.
It's Philosophy Talk's sixth annual summer reading show.
And we've got a caller on the line now. It's Laura in Mountain View. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Laura.
Thank you.
So, Laura, what's your suggestion for our summer reading?
My suggestion is the book Wild Comfort, The Solace of Nature by Kathleen Dean Moore.
Oh, Kathleen Dean Moore we know well. We had her on the program last year. She's up at Oregon State University. What's the book about?
It's a collection of her essays. It's nature essays. In the collection, she's kind of keenly observing nature. Sometimes nature acts in ways that are unexpected to her. She has some, really, some of the essays are just absolutely gorgeous. They range from maybe just three or four pages, and some are longer. And she does tie in philosophy, different thoughts from different philosophers in the essays.
What's a philosophical insight that you got from reading this book?
One of my favorite essays was called The Patience of Herons. And, you know, I love to go out to the marsh and watch the herons. So I especially love this one. And she's talking about this one heron that, you know, there's a downpour. It's sitting in a downpour of rain, and all the other herons have left, but this one just sits there stoically. And she doesn't know what it's looking at. She can't see what it sees, but it's waiting for something. And she talked about Spinoza, the philosopher Spinoza, and how passion was the opposite of action, and so that this heron was actually passionate.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
I never thought of that.
That sounds like a great transition in thought.
Exactly. What I found interesting about this book is that sometimes nature, you know, wasn't comforting. And I think that's why it's wild comfort.
Oh, I see.
It's unexpected, sometimes chaotic, sometimes cruel. You know, she's dealing with, when she's writing this book, deaths of two friends, a son of a close friend and also another close friend of hers. So sometimes nature is unexpected and chaotic, and sometimes it's comforting.
Oh, so this is cool. This is a much more complex view than I first thought, but when you started describing it. So I think I'm going to definitely put this book, Wild Comfort, The Solace of Nature by Kathleen Dean Moore, on my summer reading list.
Okay, good.
Thanks so much for sharing it with us, Laura.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've got another contributor to our sixth annual summer reading show. That's Stanka from Toronto. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stanka.
Hello.
Hi, Stanka. Tell us your suggestion for summer reading.
Well, I'd like to recommend a book called The Fate of Place by Edward Casey, who is a professor of philosophy at Stony Brook. And it's a book that traces the history of the concept of place in philosophy.
The concept of place, you mean like spatial location or like my home, my country?
In contemporary world, I guess where, you know, the question of the physical location and the virtual location that we start to think of more and more is a topic, I think, to think about place might be really interesting. And this is a book that's 400 pages long, but I guess you can read it off and on and in bits and pieces.
So I could imagine different things it's about. It could be about sort of relative versus absolute space, the idea of space being your position being relative to a frame of reference and all that. Is that the kind of thing it's about?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that it's about. And it does, I mean, it presents this history of location in an extremely readable and simple way. So although it sounds really abstract, it actually breaks it down and makes it quite simple. And I think it could be a really interesting introduction to quite difficult concepts and philosophies that you otherwise wouldn't engage with.
So this gets at some deep, hard philosophical problems in a way that makes it accessible to not a philosopher specialized in this stuff?
I think so. I'm not a philosopher and I've been enjoying it.
Oh, really? Oh, that's good. So that's a good recommendation. What do you think, John?
Stanka, did this change your idea of what it is to be in a place? Do you now feel that you know, you're in Toronto, but you're also on the internet or in the cosmos? Did it change the way you think about where you are?
Well, I think what it did for me is that it brought up the question of place in the first place, so to speak. I guess I never thought about place as a concept. You know, you just sort of are, and you don't really reflect on what that might mean.
Well, so this sounds like true philosophy in a way. It takes your mind and takes it to really unexpected places, and I'm glad that you're not a philosopher and you're willing to recommend this philosophy text.
Not for the beach.
But not for the beach, but for a serious-minded person who's willing to dig in over the summer.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Stanka, who's calling from Toronto, Canada. Her suggestion is The Fate of Place, A Philosophical History by Edward S. Casey.
Thanks so much for the recommendation, Stanka, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. There's a place,
there's a place. Ken, we've got Jeff Nunberg on the line. Jeff is a professor at Berkeley in the School of Information, and he's an old friend of Philosophy Talk. He's been on several times to discuss his own very readable books. Jeff is also the language commentator on Terry Gross's show on NPR.
Hey, Jeff, good to have you on the show again.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so what do you want to recommend to our vast listening audience for their summer reading pleasure, Jeff?
Well, pleasure, I don't know, but edification, I can tell you. I've been reading a book by Martin Jay, Marty Jay is a colleague, a historian of ideas at Berkeley, called The Virtues of Mendacity.
The Virtues of Mendacity. You mean the virtue of lying?
The virtue of lying, or the virtues of lying, yeah. Or whether there are some, or what are the limits on lying, or what's the moral basis for truth-telling, and when is it okay to lie? It's an extraordinary book. It's a liberal education in itself. It's a topic on which everybody from Plato to Machiavelli to Burke to Hannah Arendt had something to say, usually something interesting to say.
Well, now, the last book I read on lying was by Cecilia Bach, and she was, on the whole, pretty much against it.
Well, she was, and that's a point of view. But there is a point of view that says lying is not only sometimes necessary, but even on occasion a virtuous thing to do.
So tell me an example of what Martin Jay takes to be a virtue or a potential virtue of lying. I mean, what's an example?
Well, think of the diplomatic lie, for instance. The old definition of a diplomat is someone who's sent abroad to lie for his country. Now, I know that if I had been a diplomat dealing with Pakistan before the Osama raid was about to be launched, and he said, you got anything planned? I'd say, no, we're just hanging around this weekend.
So this sounds like a great book. It sounds like is it a good read?
It's a good read. It's a very learned book, but it covers this extraordinary amount of territory, but I think it is a good read. The Virtues of Mendacity.
So how long is it?
Oh, how long is it? Well, I've got it in front of me. Not that long. 180 pages.
Oh, that's a short read. I thought you were going to say 500 pages. I think I'm going to put that on my summer reading list. That sounds like a fascinating book. Thank you for joining us once again. It's been fun as always.
Great to talk to you both.
You can find all the books we've talked about on the show today, as well as more suggestions from our listeners and special guests, over at our website, philosophytalk.org.
And while you're there, you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. Now for the final word, we turn to our resident speed reader, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, a while back an author was doing a book signing in Florida when a fan said, "It's too bad you can't sign my Kindle." As more and more readers get their words through devices, the dilemma will be, according to Stephanie Rosenblum at the New York Times, what do authors autograph at book signings? Well, don't worry, marketing is already on it. The Florida author in question, T.J. Waters, has partnered with Robert Barrett to promote a product called Autography. Here's how it works, according to the Times. Quote, a reader poses with the author for a photograph, which can be taken with an iPad camera or an external camera. The image immediately appears on the author's iPad. If it's shot with an external camera, it's sent to the iPad via Bluetooth. Then the author uses a stylus to scroll a digital message below the photo. When finished, the author taps a button on the iPad that sends the fan an email with a link to the image, which can then be downloaded into the e-book, unquote. Well, good Lord, that sounds like a lot of work. Me, I'd probably just carve my name with an X-Acto knife on the Kindle screen, which may be why I don't get many requests for autographs. A more polite author might sign his name on the back of a Kindle with a magic marker, but wouldn't that mean the Kindle would have to be permanently devoted to showing the author's work? Wouldn't that turn your e-reader into, well, a book? A bookcase full of autographed Kindles is not only expensive, it defeats their purpose. Another question, which occurred to me after pondering this earth-shattering book-signing issue, with the advent of e-books, how will you dog-ear your pages? Used to be that a surefire way to impress a smart potential lover was to carry around a battered copy of Madame Bovary or Shakespeare's sonnets with pages folded to your favorite bits. This would indicate not only that you've read the book you're carrying, you've reread it, you've studied on it, you love it. An e-reader only tells people that you have enough money to buy an e-reader. Unless they're looking over your shoulder, they don't even know what you're reading. Could be Shakespeare, could be Shakespeare for Dummies. One of the pleasures of used books is seeing what previous readers have underlined, and what will happen to notes scribbled in the margins. Comments like, so true, or stupid, can add immeasurably to the reader's pleasure. Phone numbers scribbled in the flyleaf, gone forever, no more flyleafs. And doodles. Can you doodle in a Kindle? Like to see you try. And when a book is terrible, haven't you ever closed it shut with a curse and thrown it across the room? I'm sure you can throw a Kindle and get a nice thud out of it, but it would be a fleeting pleasure, like a rock star throwing a television into a hotel swimming pool. Nabokov once said, my ideal reader is someone who reads with a dictionary and a pencil. Pencil? What's that? The ideal reader today has to read while Googling and texting, and then be sure to tweet about it. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leah Weiss is our webmaster.
And special thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Dave Millar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.